I should have a copy of it. And just put that on the paper, okay? What, I should have a copy of it?
Yeah. Well, I would think that it's either you or Jack put in for the permit.
For the, yes, for the.
LUCS?
Yes.
Richard, you can start the meeting whenever you'd like.
Okay, we'll call this meeting in order. This is a regular commission meeting for the Port of Brookings Harbor Commission, Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. I will start with the pledge of allegiance.
Pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Danielle, roll call, please.
Larry?
Here.
Ken?
Here.
Sharon?
Here.
Richard?
Here.
Joe Spear is absent.
Okay, are there any modifications, additions, or changes to the agenda?
No.
I have one. I would like to add an information item G, which is the salmon season. A discussion about that. Anything else? All right, or does anybody need to declare a potential conflict of interest?
Yeah.
Okay. That moves us to approval of the agenda.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda with the modification.
Second. Okay, we have a motion and a second.
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes. Moves us to the approval of the meeting minutes for a regular commission meeting Wednesday, February 15th, and a special commission meeting Monday, February 20th.
I'll make a motion to approve both the minutes for both meetings as submitted.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Sharon? Danielle?
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes. Okay, that brings us to public comments. I have none in front of me. Are you aware of any?
I did not receive any public comments.
Okay. And we'll move to the management and financial report.
Okay. For the RV park, electricians have set sites 1 through 22 electrical pedestals, and Coos Curry was out with set new transformers for power upgrades. Early March 2023, Coos Curry Electric will be back out to install new power meters and move the light poles that landed in the middle of a new site. Staff are placing concrete dividers and installing tongue and groove boards. Last thing to do on the first 22 sites will be to loop the cable TV back into the pedestals and install the new Wi-Fi upgrade. Work has started at the north end of the park with construction happening at our new 6 sites. For sites in the back row, staff have started addressing rotted or missing fence boards, and new fences were needed. All reservations for the RV park are open starting July 1st, 2023. As soon as the first 22 sites are completed, they will be opened. When the other sites are completed, they will be opened in turn. We hope to have all the sites open by the end of March. And we're still looking good for that. I think by spring break, we should have them open. Occupancy for February was 13%. In the marina, port received notice that the first 4 pedestals on J-Dock were not working. After investigation, staff discovered the main power feed to that dock had rubbed against the piling and caused it to wear through the wire coating. The wire that feeds the dock is about 190 feet long and had to be ordered. Once the material arrives, the plan is to complete the installation by mid-March. The boat owners that were affected by the electrical outage have been notified. A couple of boats were moved at the owner's request to the boat slips with access to power. I'll lean forward. Representatives from FEMA and OEM came to our port to review the IDA, which is the initial disaster assessment. for the storm on December 25th and 26th of 2022. All pictures, cost estimates, and forms have been filled out, and we will wait to see if there is a state-declared disaster to access any funds. Staff filled out an application for the lottery bond funding for the West Bank repair in Basin 2. Due to the uncertainty of the bank, West Bank repair through HMGP, I made the decision to move the project to the front of that list to get that funding. Boat launches paid through the launch machine. The modem is down in it. It broke. It's been in there for 5 years or so, but we do got a new one, and it was installed this week, so I'll have those numbers updated in our next meeting. Telehandler work, we did two jobs. We had one haul out for the month of February. In the commercial receiving docks, the public hoist is operational. Grease and all bearings and shivs were visually inspected. Hallmark Seafood, operational, but they will need more fender pilings and support piles at some point. Bornstein Seafood, operational. Storm drainage in this area is undersized and should be upgraded in the future. Pacific Seafood, operational. Their north dock support beams at the north end of the dock are starting to show signs of rotting. New Pacific Seafood dock, another fender piling was bent and pulled off the dock. Pile will need to be resecured with gussets, and the port will work with Pacific Seafood to make time to do that work. And then I went through and I also took pictures of all the dock surfaces and support structures underneath the docks in order to log current conditions to show deficiencies that will need to be addressed. Commercial retail building, staff created an advertisement for board approval for proposals to repair the old motorcycle shop. We will be going over that in an action item this meeting. Bell and Whistle also asked to move their leased area to the front row. We did create an amendment for that for board approval in this meeting as well. Beacon Broadband is almost done with the installation of their mainline infrastructure. They will be finishing up at the launch ramp and retail area by the end of March. Tri-County Asphalt has been contracted to come through and complete the needed patches throughout the port when weather permits. Maintenance crew completed 93 work orders for the month of February 2023. Dock maintenance included cleat replacement, bolt tightening, and three piling hoops replaced on PQ main dock. And then quarterly dock inspections were completed for the first quarter of 2023. Port received notice that a fender piling was pulled off at the new Pack Choice dock. Staff were able to use the dock crane and pull the piling back up and resecure it to the dock. A welder, John's Portable Welding, was brought in and gussets were placed on each side of that fender piling to add strength. During the repair, we noticed numerous pilings were beginning to break at the weld and more gussets will need to be installed. Two new straps were added to the travel lift along with monthly maintenance and inspections. Boats that are impounded in the boatyard were checked and pumped out if needed. In March, staff will look at the current standings on the two vessels and arrange to have them demolished and sent to CTR so final billing can be completed. And then water testing for the 1200Z permit was completed and logged. After we receive the results, we will meet with the engineer to review the issues and discuss any corrective action that may be needed. Port staff continue to clean and maintain gear storage areas in order to facilitate better water quality in these areas. Office staff, both new office personnel started in February. Training for new employees have started and both individuals are performing well. April, Danielle and I went to Sun River for the SCAO conference. It was very informative and gave the staff a great opportunity to network with other entities. DEQ Oregon material survey was completed and returned. The survey requires the port to enter the amount of waste oil disposed, metal that was recycled, and a hazardous material survey that accounts for material stored at the port. Jack Aiken came into the office to help the new staff organize and submit reports to FEMA, hazard mitigation, and wastewater treatment plant. The training with Mr. Aiken was constructive for our staff who engaged in the learning the necessary documents and procedures to facilitate effective project management. Our record keeping will match engineer records so that during the conversations, our staff will understand what is being asked. I know it's a lot. Any questions?
Travis, on this boat, the boat launch machine that you have, so when you give us a report every month, you report how many launches went through the machine, but does it also record how many people rent the slip that we have over there?
Mm-hmm. I can add that to the report.
Yeah. So we can kind of keep track of actually how much we're actually using those slips.
Yeah, we can definitely take, I can add that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Next, the safety, security, and environmental monthly report. In the safety end, port staff discussed hard hat safety. There was 3 incidents recorded for the month of February, bringing the year total to 6. Incidents included a fishing vessel backed into another fishing vessel. Individuals were contacted and advised to contact insurance. A liveaboard customer went to their vehicle and had a broken window. We reviewed the camera footage but could not see any foul play due to location of vehicle. Port staff found a needle in the men's commercial restroom. Needle was disposed of properly. Security, 4 Aces Solution recorded 35 security issues for the month of February, bringing the year total to 41. There was 32 overnight parking tickets, 2 unauthorized visitors on port property after hours, and 1 emergency services were called. A lot of the overnight parking was deckhands that hasn't came in and got parking passes. That was a lot of them. On the environmental and the 1200Z industrial stormwater permit, monthly inspections were completed as required by the stormwater pollution control plan. And stormwater testing was completed during the recent storms. This was the first of our 4 tests required for this year.
Emergency services, who are they and what were they called for?
It was after hours, I'm not sure. It just reports 4 ACES says emergency services, but sometimes they couldn't
call
details,
sheriff
sometimes.
Or fire department or anything like that.
No. It wasn't anything where it was a major concern.
I think for the record we should know that we have over 100 uninvited trespassers on our dock right now. I don't know. That's a dock that has the electrical problem that they're all on. Does that have had something to do with it?
No, not on where this was, but damage to the pedestals. That's ongoing. They're breaking the lids off, the arms off, which just adds on costs. Last year was about $15,000 total, with man hours included, with labor parts and putting it back together. But we haven't even been back down to check, you know, other than scaring them off to see how bad it really actually is yet. We put the new dancing things back up today and seemed to help, but now they're going over to other docks.
I know, they moved over, some of them to the commercial.
Yeah, they are a problem.
They are.
Travis, I got a question. You are, the port is aware that you have the right to harass those with paintball guns and other non-lethal methods to keep them off from destroying port property, correct?
Yes.
So have we tried paintball or airsoft guns to shoot at them to try to deter them from coming back and being repeat offenders? I understand the public perception that we're shooting them, but this is given to us. The private property owners and such are given that right under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
I can comment a little bit on that from the perspective of other ports that have done that. Their basic commentary to me was, it's good as long as you're there.
Yeah.
But the moment you leave, they're right back. So, you know, there are some ports that take high-pressure fire hoses out of them and literally blow them off the dock, and that still doesn't do the job.
I think most of the problem that we run into, no matter what you do, there's nowhere else for them to go. Our docks are, I mean, when they all come in here, when the weather's bad like that, they're not going to go back out the mouth. And
the
public perception has always been a concern to me about doing things like that. You know, where's the, I don't see it as being effective long term, so that's why
I'm
going.
And I know it's not your area, but I mean, Marine Mammal Protection Act, there's issues with it, we all can understand, but yeah, until we start fleecing that population, we're going to have this all the time, so.
Yeah, I actually look back on my pictures. It was a year exactly to the day when they came back, and it was the exact same, I mean, to the day. So.
Well, they're here for the steelhead.
Yeah, they were here last year for
the
steelhead, too.
For them right now, the fact that we've got out migrating steelhead, and we usually have some herring showing up about this time of year, which is why they're here. It's not just coincidentally they just showed up. They're on a regular schedule because they're smart enough to know that. So,
and honestly, the way, it's not even a great answer to it, but they are confined to one area. I really, the rest of our, they're our strongest docks. Those fingers are solid concrete fingers. If we get them up on other docks, they're going to break them a lot more, which, like I said, not a great answer, but they are confined to one spot, and they're not on every dock and every open slip that we have. Because I think it would just create a lot more damage throughout. I wish I had a great answer for that.
No, I know you didn't.
Well, the answer, I mean, the best remedy is if ports coast-wide can get together to try and persuade Congress to at least have some mechanism for us to be reimbursed for damage. You know, right, this is a very typical piece of feel-good federal legislation that protects them, but it doesn't go to the next logical step, which is how do you control populations? At what level do you control them? And what do you do to reimburse people who have damage? I mean, this is nothing compared to Monterey. I mean, in Monterey, they're sinking boats. They've done a huge amount of damage. And so the boat owner and his insurance company are left holding the bag for, you know, three stellar sea lions climbing up on your sailboat and breaking it up and sinking it. So it's just, there's got to be a better solution.
And there is costs that are already happening to boat owners that are on that dock with the boat, with the fenders getting ripped off, you know, hoses, cords getting pulled off and then end up in the water that have to be fished back out, and the salt water is horrible on them. So it is unfortunate, but like you say, I mean, there's places that have a lot worse problem. We're kind of fortunate to have a minor problem, I would consider, when you put us up against other places. But
where is it temporary?
It is temporary.
It's seasonal, and then they move on, you know, as opposed to the Columbia River or they never.
Right.
So, I just thought for the record, we had a note that we do have a marine mammal problem.
Great. All right. Financial summary for February. End of the month, unrestricted cash and equivalents totaled $420,901. Restricted cash and equivalents totaled $639,985, with total checkings and savings at $1,135,579. Total revenue for all funds was $346,024. Total expenses was $361,940. The net income for February was negative $15,916. February general fund revenues, they were at $334,678, and those fund revenues expenditures were $180,184. Those big deficits are from McClintic checks, from payments. by Sean McLennan.
Well, it looked like the place that we lost money at the marina and the general fund.
That's the only one that, yeah, where we lost. But historically, that happens. Total income for all funds is at 47.2%. Sorry, this is the budget performance. Total income for all funds is at 47.2%, with general fund revenues at 58.9%. Total expenditure for all funds is at 36.1%, with general fund expenditure at 58.6%.
So currently what that means is that's based against budgeted amounts?
Yes, based against budgeted amounts.
Okay. I asked Travis. With the RV park being closed at $92,000, what, you actually made that much, or
that? It's from, we can get our reservation, we have our reservations, we accept money, right. Reservations up to 6 months in advance. So some of that money coming in is from July reservations.
Okay, so July should be down then, because it's already been made, right?
July should be down, when we get to July,
yeah.
You'll see it go down some. It still makes money for the rest of the summer, you know, and stuff. Yeah. But the wintertime, it always sees a little bit better. Typically, we like to see this money start coming in earlier, but because we have all the sites shut down right now up until July, so I know they're going to be operational and working, that's why we're starting to see that number, and we haven't seen it yet.
So is there some way to break that out, what you physically took in and what was come in on reservation?
For what we actually took in on February?
Yeah. I guess what you took in on reservation. Or does there even need to know that?
The occupancy at the RV park was at 13%. So there is backup documentation in here that I give them that goes over how many people were here and actual total revenue. I just don't include that.
Okay.
Any other questions?
All right. Any comments, questions? Hearing none, take a motion to accept the finance and management financial report.
I'll make a motion to accept the financial report.
Management financial
report.
Okay. Motion in a second. Danielle?
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes. Okay, that brings us to action items. Action item A, the Bell and Whistle mobile coffee stand lease amendment.
Okay. So the Bell and Whistle approached me and they have asked to move to the front row to increase sales, traffic, closer to people. In this, we did double their lease amount, moving to the front row, because our revenue is much higher in the front row. So they went from $250 a month to $500 a month. So as long as the board's okay with moving them to the front row, the front row sites that typically I wouldn't do this, but the front row sites that's straight where we're moving them next to the bathroom will have a major issue for RVs getting out, pulling all the way through and getting out. So this will also solve some of that problem of guests having to back out or not actually being able to make that turn.
You haven't taken any reservations on that yet, right?
We did have some, but I've already recently moved them before it got out of hand.
Cool. Thank you, Travis.
And that 500 would be every month throughout the entire year. There's not a season difference.
No. I think if we want to, we can look at how this is set up. That site is big enough for us to look at other options of maybe like another food truck of some sort in there. to help balance what our average annual income is on that. It's about, you know, it's about $10,000 a year is what we make on those front row sites. So we are coming up about half short of what those sites typically bring in with this. So I have to talk to Harbor Sanitary, and we need to look at any proposals that might be out there. But it might give us an option to put another food truck out there and get a little bit more income out of that one site.
We wouldn't change the $500 to bell and whistle. We would just collect more money from another truck.
Exactly. We'd create another lease opportunity for another truck.
And you've already answered this question, but that spot does rent. It does rent. It's not vacant. It's vacant.
It does rent, yeah.
Okay. Question? Brewer? Motion?
I'll make a motion to approve Bell and Whistle's mobile coffee stand lease amendment number one.
Second. Okay, we have a motion and second. Danielle?
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yeah. Action item B, McLennan Excavation Payment Request Number 7.
So this is continuing payments on the contract amount. This one's at $84,033.22. The remaining balance, I think, is attached to here. $69,250 is left for the project to be paid. So we'll have this one and one more should be all wrapped up and done.
Okay. Questions? Comments? All right.
I make a motion.
Okay.
Motion to approve McLennan Excavation Progress Payment Number 7 for $84,033.22 for work performed February 9, 2023 to March 6, 2023 per contract.
Second. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Danielle?
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes. That brings us to El Cazadores. Draft lease agreement.
Okay, so we've talked about this a lot. The board, El Cazadores presented the board with a lease-to-own type option that we reviewed. We came out of that meeting, we decided that we were going to go down the lease option, and after I presented the lease to, Cindy, she then stated she would be willing to pay for the property at the full amount with no lease-to-own options, just buy it outright. So I told her that we would come back to the board one last time, given the new circumstances. So the board, what I'm asking is, do we want to go down a lease option, or do we want to go back down the purchase option? And then I will work with James to do a purchase sale agreement, and you know, we might have to have another executive session about it, but this is just to give me direction in which way to go with this.
So the last time we discussed this under the idea that we were going to carry paper, basically, we ran up against some Business Oregon issues with us having to front the money to them and hadn't hoped we'd pay. This circumvented that problem. So this is a direct sale with 80% going to Business Oregon and the remainder coming to us.
To our reserve fund, yes.
Right. Okay. All right.
So, yeah, given the new information, which way do we want to go? I gave us two options for a motion. Looking for that direction.
Sale price is still 52.
Yes.
Nothing's changed in my position. I don't see selling port property, especially on that low flat ground down there. They're willing to lease it. I think that's what we should be doing. The money involved in the sale is not that significant. We get very little of it in actual to use or that we can use.
And given our last conversation, our last meeting about the lease and going with a longer-term lease and looking at a different rate given the longer-term lease, this lease option gave them, it was five. It was at 12 cents per square foot, so it's $450 a month, which is up from the $250 a month they're paying now. So that was kind of the bottom of what we could do as far as a lease rate to them at a long-term lease.
And they're okay leasing at the $450?
I think they, given your decision will be, your guys' decision will be what they have to, you know, live with. $450 was the best that we could, that
I could reasonably do. Does the port keep 100% of that $450?
Yes, that would be us retaining the money. That would be us just retaining the money, just like it was a normal lease. And I did put in this lease for it. It will have regular annual CPI increases, which was not included in there.
Well, I'll restate my position on this. I do think we should sell this. I don't see this as a piece of property the port's going to use. It's obviously intended to serve that building. A continual lease on this will mean that every time that property changes hands, it's going to have to come through us for approval. It's encumbering that business, in my view, unnecessarily. I don't know how it got the way it is, but it is the way it is. And so from my perspective, I would much rather sell that piece of property, make it pertinent to the business itself, and not have us have to mess with it.
And it also helps decrease our debt.
Well,
a little bit.
But I mean, the point of this is that, to me, I mean, we're under no obligation to help businesses out, but, you know, in terms of trying to do the right thing for the community, I think it makes more sense to us to just solve that problem and be on guard for something like that coming up again. Like I said, I don't know how it got that way, but it got that way. So for us to use that property is going to be pretty much pointless. We're, you know, they can't, we're right at their back door. I don't know what we could use it for that would be compatible with that business. I just don't see that the port needs to retain that piece of property. By taking this action, we can fix the problem and make them whole, and at the same time realize some income for us.
Any other comments?
So Travis, the Business Oregon, they wouldn't allow you to put these funds, just like they did the property across the street, onto like one of our projects?
Due to the dollar amount and how the lower dollar amount there was, I didn't ask.
Oh.
What's the percentage? If we do a sale, what's the percentage of that? Let's just say $50,000 that would go to Business Oregon. What percentage do we keep?
It would be about $40,000 to Business Oregon, and $10,000 would be put into our reserve fund. And we still, in the purchase sale agreement, we'd have to work out closing costs and any costs associated with the sale and how. Who's going to be responsible for that? Because any cost that we incur from that would come from that $10,000.
She'll go through the attorney at 3:15.
I'm going to try to, you know, do a little bit more of that sale on my end, on our end. But, you know, of course, we will have attorney fees associated with this as well.
So we have attorney fees associated with the lease?
We got attorney. Anytime we do a lease, there's attorney fees. It's just.
Do you, as port manager, see that piece of property as viable in the near future for us to do boat storage, crab pot storage, anything? Do you have any plans for that?
Currently, right now, the port does not have any plans set out for that.
On the surface of this, the restaurant owners will take whatever the commissioners give them, which would be a sale or a lease. Off the top here, the lease is going to collect the port more money. Plus, I mean, listen, if you have to come back every other year, put it back on the table, that's not a big project for the commissioners themselves. But if there's money to be made by leasing this property, then selling, by all means, I think the port should capitalize on leasing it. I agree with you.
And then we get to the point where the business goes out of business and we have nothing.
So I think it's relevant, too, that we remember that we didn't build that building, we didn't set the property lines, but the property line goes right down the back of the building. They can't step out that back door without stepping onto port property. So that is very unfortunate for the business owners as well, to have to deal with that.
If it comes down to that, I mean, why don't we just lose it? If it comes down to, like, they come up to you, the commissioner said, we just can't do it anymore, then maybe you might want to negotiate that.
Well, I think realistically, I mean, I'm not going to speak to the viability of that restaurant and, you know, whatever's in there, but this community, if you drive around, has a history of a vacant building. But the businesses have gone away, and then we're sitting there holding the bag. Basically, we're getting nothing off of that piece of property.
There is maybe a third option that kind of just hit me, is that we could look at a lot line adjustment to keep their business within, you know, a proper setback of a property line versus ours, and which would reduce the leasable footprint. Kind of, we could let them, you know, they could buy the property that would be needed to give them the proper setbacks. It's kind of splitting it down the middle, but it's just kind of another option that would solidify the building and not have it on our property line. But
in that business and that building are privately owned. That's not port property.
That restaurant is not port property, no.
So if they went vacant, it's up to whoever the current owner was to take care of it.
The building, yes. Yeah. We're just talking the asphalt parking area.
Are you ready for a motion, Richard?
Yep.
I'll make a motion to approve El Cardoza draft lease agreement.
We want to second that one.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion and a second, Danielle.
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
No.
Richard?
No. So we have no third.
If Jill was here, he'd say no.
Well, just for the record, I'll make a motion that we make a motion to approve the port manager to work with legal counsel to create a purchase sale agreement for the full asking price and have the port manager contact Business Oregon for a lease of for leasing documentation.
Any seconds?
I didn't know he was making a motion. I thought he was asking you to do something.
That was a motion.
I made a motion.
Thank you. Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to achieve the sale. Danielle?
Larry?
No.
Ken?
No.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yeah.
Now James is online. I do not know.
I don't know if I've ever that
one. Well, it appears to me we were at an impasse here. So I would suggest that we have this on to the next meeting. Hopefully we'll have five here. And we'll try it again.
Okay.
Everybody okay with that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. Appoint the budget officer.
Okay. The last several years, Kim Boom has been appointed the budget officer. This year, Kim is not here, so I have myself as kind of a placeholder to be the budget officer. I think with our new staff and the direction we're going, I think I just might be the better candidate, in my opinion, for it than turning it on to any of our other staff, at least for this year.
Okay. Comment?
Well, I just have one question. Why aren't we doing it with April? Is she not qualified and you're more qualified, or she needs to be brought up to speed? I don't follow why you need to wear a third hat.
Well,
you're ultimately responsible as the port manager, but you supervise the people that are doing the work. So I'm kind of lost on why April isn't doing it when she's our budget person now.
I haven't really assigned anybody, like our budget personnel. April is in charge of our finances and, you know, keeps our books together. She's hasn't been a part of our budgets before, and that's kind of what led me to, due to the lack of knowledge in the budget process that we have, that's why I put it in there. I'm sure April wouldn't have a problem stepping into that position. I was just trying to alleviate some of that load or anything that came up that, you know, on the budget that, you know, we're all new to it, and I really wasn't ready to throw her into the lion's den if we didn't have to. But again, I think she will take on the responsibility, no problem. My name in here is just a placeholder. I should have probably just left it blank. But with her sitting here, we can ask April, you know, anybody you guys would like to see as the budget officer, we can talk about and look at.
Well, I know you have personally been working on the budget yourself.
Yeah, one of the things that we talked about when I started this was that the budget is one of the things that I haven't been a part of. I've always given my information, looked at it, been a part of it, but as far as actually creating it, I haven't done that. April hasn't done that before. Danielle's been helping, and she hasn't been through that whole entire process yet. So I do have Gary helping me get our budget done, and
so the reality of the budget officer is this is a position whose responsibility it is to make sure that we follow the process, that we have the right number of meetings, that we have a public committee that helps us, and that we have the budget done and approved on a certain day. That's really the function of the budget officer. So,
okay.
I mean, I'm guessing, but I think that's probably formal duties of the budget officer to make sure that that process is followed. So I would have no concern about appointing April a budget officer to go through that. Ultimately, we are going to be responsible for this budget. This is our budget. It's not the staff's budget. It's our budget. So what we're talking about here is a process, a formal process of making sure that all the steps are followed so we don't have to do that. Because frankly, I don't know what they are and you guys do. So I think the role of the budget officer is just that for us.
Can we ask April? She's sitting right there. Are you comfortable taking it, or?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, I don't think the penalty is more than 3 years in the penitentiary.
I was going to say, it's been 3 to 5, depending on good behavior.
Sorry, that was out of line. Okay, I would entertain a motion on the budget officer.
Okay,
I'll make a motion. Go ahead, Sean.
I'll make a motion to approve April Walker as budget officer for fiscal year 2023-2024 budget.
I'll second.
Okay,
we have a motion and a second.
Danielle.
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Sharon?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes.
So since we're on the subject here for budget, behind that action item is the budget calendar that we are going to be shooting to try and follow. We're going to have a special meeting in early April to appoint the budget committee. The budget committee has two vacancies. That ad for budget committee members will be going out.
It's on the website.
On the website already.
It's going to be in the paper.
Yeah. So we'll be taking those applications, and then I was talking to Richard, and he said he wasn't going to be available April 7th. I would like to have as many commissioners here, so April 5th, the following week at April 10th.
Yes. I'm pretty sure I'm here, but no.
Okay. So we will update number 2 on the calendar. Let's go April 10th, which is a Monday.
That's going to be a 2.
And we'll call that 2 p.m. And we will have a couple other items on that special meeting as well, so I would allow for probably an hour's worth of meeting.
Question. Did two vacancies, how did they become vacant? People dropped off, backed out?
One was vacant from last year that the position wasn't filled, and the other one, the term, and
who was that?
June 2020. So maybe we only have one.
Yeah,
we have one. As long as our calendar stays here and we get everything done and adopted by what we have to by June 30th. So we have one available position. The other one will be up in June, July 1st.
Who comes up?
Richard, I always mess up his name. Constable.
Yeah.
Well,
didn't Tom Bain move?
Yeah, Tom is gone.
Tom is still in town.
Tom is gone.
He resigned from his budget. All right. So we're good with this now?
Yep.
Okay.
Information item A, port rates. Okay. So the port rates, I wanted to just talk about again. I added to our rates that haven't ever been a part of our rates is a landing fee. This landing fee will be associated to all port dock hoists and their leases, including our public hoists will also contribute to this. The reason being is that the port, our docks have always, our receiving docks have always been an issue. We do have one dock that has been condemned for 5 or 6 years now. The port doesn't, has never set aside monies for these dock repairs, nor do we have any funding or money set aside currently for any repairs associated with our receiving docks as far as fender pilings, support pilings, and any major drainage issues that, that come up. I've added a lot of pictures in here of our receiving docks, different issues. All of them have hoists that are nearing their age, Hallmark if you use them in particularly. They're still operational, but those types of hoists, the way those things are were designed and engineered, will no longer be accepted as far as new infrastructure goes. So the cost of dock hoists are going to go up, the engineering of them are going to go up, and for us to start being able to meet those future needs, I think we need to start setting aside some money by way of landing fee. So on the last page of our rates, where we have our public hoist fees, number letter C, landing fees associated with all leased port dock hoists for repairs, future needs, and upgrades. The price would be one cent per pound on crab and a half a cent per pound on shrimp, fish, and any other species that is unloaded here. I didn't go too deep into that because there's not a lot of other species unloaded here. If in the future we find more and we want to break that price up, we could. I did discuss this with Pacific Seafood, Brett there. I talked to the dock managers at both Hallmark and Orenstein Seafoods to kind of gather any information or, you know, how they thought about it. The dock managers seem to be in favor of it. Hallmark and Borenstein's headquarters or supervisors of that never called me back or got back in touch with me. So I took in as much as I could from everybody, but I think for the future needs of what we have, I think it's time we start setting aside some money to address those issues.
So to be clear here, the intent would be if we collect these funds, they're going to go into an earmarked place in our budget,
mm-hmm.
or in our
reserve fund.
Bookkeeping. Mm-hmm. So they'll be distinguished apart from other funds,
mm-hmm.
and the intent for us would be to use those funds for repair and maintenance of the receiving docks and associated equipment.
Yes. And it would require the board to discuss those fixes. It takes board action to take money out of our reserve fund to use for any necessary repairs. So it's not anything that will be decided by one person how to use those funds. It will have to happen by a public meeting. It'll also look at giving us options for grants. I don't expect us to probably utilize or spending this money for a year, 2-3 years out, let the pool build a little bit, and then really look at, you know, what our major needs are and what we need to tackle first.
So would we be, would it be clear and transparent if we memorialize what we just discussed in a resolution?
Absolutely. If this is approved and we go, we will do a resolution adopting our rates, and then we'll do a separate resolution just for the landing fees and its dedicated purpose to the reserve fund and the receiving funds.
Question.
We would do a resolution.
Do you have a guesstimate what the crab and shrimp would bring in on an annual
basis? So the way I've kind of added, I wanted to see first, but I'm guessing between $50,000 and $75,000 a year is to be the projected revenue. On good years, it could be more, but I would expect $50,000 on the low end. I think Pacific Seafood, the last time I talked to them, they're somewhere in the neighborhood of almost $3 million.
2.2, 2.3 million.
Yeah, that they've landed already. You know, so given that and given their previous years, I think $50,000 to $75,000 would be a fair number to estimate at this point.
So ultimately, the reality of this is if we have this fund established and we are able to find grant money, most likely that would be reimbursable at three times what we would put in. So we'd have to pay a quarter on most grants. Some of them are different, but if we had this money available, we could leverage it. But our intent or our hope would be to be able to leverage it and get a lot more out of it than just what we've got available here.
Right.
Okay.
Like I said, the funds will need to be, you know, decided on specifically to our receiving docks, dock hoists, drainage, fender pilings, things like that. But, you know, once we have that, we find a grant opportunity. It's not that we can't include, you know, we can try and include as much of our docks as possible. It'll give us a lot more options to look at once we have some money, matching funds to come to the table with.
Well, I think the wording of the resolution is going to be important.
Yeah.
So that we're clear on what we do without building too big of a box for us to say this is the only thing you can use these for. So that would be, to me, the key to it is how we word the resolution.
Okay. We'll take a careful look at that. It's just after talking to the receiving docs, talking to the dock managers, they're very supportive as long as we make sure that when we're doing this that we put ourselves in the best position by resolution to dedicate these funds for that purpose.
I think the biggest fear on the part of the public and the people who are using the docks is it just goes in a black hole somewhere and never see it again. So
as we've been going through our next year's budget, it's already been incorporated into that. It's under our reserve fund. It has its own line item there that'll get all installed if we approve this. So it will be a very closely tracked and very easy to see what is done with the money because of the difficulty getting it out and using it.
This is not unprecedented. They do this in Crescent City.
In Crescent City, they have landing fees. So I did call other ports. Crescent City does have landing fees. Charleston does not. Newport at their commercial dock is all they have is a landing fee for squid, which is about 4.5 cents a pound. Newport does have landing fees associated with their international docks. And then Astoria does not charge any landing fees to the receiving docks that are owned by the processing companies. But other docks that they have, they do have different tariffs and charges for boats associated with docking and landing, but they're in forms of tariffs and labor and tie-up. And
it's important to remember that Astoria has an awful lot of timber, wood products, things, non-traditional fish type things that they move back and forth across those docks, cars. Anyway, I know there's a lot of timber, logs, stuff that goes across it. So.
Yeah, Crescent City was the closest port with any type of fee associated that they have.
All right. Question. How are the leases written up for the port receiving docks scattered throughout Halston, Hallmark, Forest, and the factories in regards to maintenance of those facilities?
maintenance is required. Anything damaged is required by them. Anything that's beyond normal wear and tear. So it kind of leaves a little bit, you know, what's normal wear and tear, you know, Hallmark, you know, the Hallmark docks in those leased areas. You know, if they break a hoist, they would be responsible. The motors, you know, things like that, lack of maintenance, but the actual replacement of the hoist, especially given how old they are, I don't think they would be responsible for it.
I think there's the question would be, this is infrastructure of the port, owned by the port. So I think that long-term maintenance and repair would be up to the port. What you're talking about is repairing damage.
Which they would be responsible
for. Which they would be responsible for, but I can't in any way find a plausible scenario where it would become the responsibility of the leasee to pay for our infrastructure.
It has happened that way in the past.
No, I'm not sure that's the right way.
Let's just say for fact.
Okay. I don't think we've ever charged anybody for the wood rot or.
Hallmark did that back in the 80s, replacing the surrounding docks at their expense.
Well, that may be because the port didn't have the money too, but I don't go back that far.
There has definitely been different cases throughout the years the port has not had the money, such as if we ran into it now and has made arrangements, you know, with other docs if they're investing the money that something comes back to them in some way, shape, or form.
Just curious because I know it has happened in the past.
Well, there
was in the 90s, not the 80s.
There again, if we're going to do a resolution about this, that can be some of the kind of things we talk about and what's ours, what's going to get fixed, and so on.
And I think, you know, something else that's coming is future regulations with dock hoists. You know, these current dock hoists that we have out here, there's no per se rating, you know, tag on them. They are becoming, you couldn't even go get somebody to build you just one of those and stick them out the way they were. Any person that makes these hoists or anything also have to follow engineering rules, you know, processes, stamps, you know, the whole nine yards, which I've looked into this exercise kind of with these dock hoists and what we will be looking at between $125,000 and $150,000 per hoist probably installed at each one. And with the new hoist, like what's on Pacific Seafood's new dock, which has a greater capacity, the engineering, I don't even know if our docks would support one of those. Yet. So there's going to be, no matter what, future engineering costs are going to have to go into the dock just to be able to support these as well.
I'm assuming, and maybe Jack can answer this, I'm assuming anytime you have something like a hoist, you have some OSHA stuff that's probably required for that?
Yeah, of course you have OSHA. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Lots of, I can't cite it off the top of my head, but I have seen it before. I can provide that for you if you want.
Back with the increase, proposed increase for the dock and the percentage if you will increase it, what's your dirty figure on replacing what needs to be fixed without any help from the grants? What would you think of money would take to replace what needs to be replaced there?
On all the docks?
So we're just talking about why you're increasing the rate on.
I think you're probably close. I mean, for the current docks that we have right now, just where they're failing, the substructure underneath the concrete makes it very difficult, fixes the end water work period, makes it more expensive. I think you could easily look at $2.5 to $3 million just to go through and fix the needed things that need to be fixed. But a lot of what I'm seeing and what I figure would happen is to get to those fixes, you're going to be replacing a lot more dock, which is going to make the cost climb.
Okay, so here's the point. With that little increase in good year, you guys, the port's going to make $75,000. $75,000 times whatever that number is to replace the dock is a lot of years.
you know,
if you don't get any help, so.
If you don't get any help, you're right, it'll take a while, but.
12 years.
Current funding that's available for, that's out there to apply for, there's a lot of money out there, there's a lot of different opportunities. Again, it goes back to with the port, is that, you know, the matching funds for those projects have always been an issue for us. And I think that if we can put this money away for enough time, you know, and come up with $250,000, we could easily look at a $1 million project, and grant monies, and get going somewhere.
It's all about keeping that money out of the black hole, you know, like you guys discussed before, the years lapsed, all of a sudden you use the money for A to pay for B, then you gotta.
Between resolution and it going onto our budget as a line item, if it goes onto our budget and everything's approved and it goes through, that line item won't even fall off our budget. Even if you stopped putting any money to it, that line item on the budget wouldn't fall off for 3 years. So you would always see it in your budget, you know, you would see it and, but my main goal is not that, you know, nobody wants this money to go into a black hole. I think it's a great opportunity for us to make up deficits that this port's never been able to do. You know, being able to show that, let people see it, and then be able to go out there and do the work and have it shown, I think it's just in everybody's interest to have it as well known and put out there what that money's being used for.
Thank you for that explanation.
Well, so memorializing this in a resolution just merely signals the intent of this commission, and because we're establishing this fee. Can't bind future commissions on what they may want to do with it, but I think there's been a lack of some of this in the past where things were done and nobody really was around to say, well, this is why we did it. Mm-hmm. That's just how it is. And, you know, I don't want to presume what they did was not well thought out because I wasn't around when they did a lot of things, but. And I'll use the grain building as an example. I mean, obviously, there had to have been a huge amount of discussion about that building and what it was going to be for, and on and on and on, and we know what the end result was. So that's why I think the resolution to define this will be important, so that at least going forward, people will know what we were thinking about when we decided to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more on port fees?
So port rates will be brought back to us on the next regular meeting for approval. So you guys, it'll be an action item on our next meeting.
Okay.
Would you say one cent per crab?
1 cent per crown and a half a cent for shrimp and fish and any other species brought.
Unless it's hagfish. That we're going to want to charge a lot of money for those. So that brings us to information item B, the IDA completion of the storm damage.
So the initial damage assessment was completed after FEMA and OEM came and did a walkthrough of our port down in our docks, and they took their own pictures, and we kept refining what was claimable, you know, through their program, and that number was brought down to $378,144. You'll see at Category A, the debris clearance, two different sites, which was the launch ramp and the RV park. Those bills totaled $8,254. D, which was water control facilities, which was our basins and our banks, the total amount that was claimable through those was just what was impacted during that storm event. So we weren't able to go with the method of using it as a whole system in that scenario. With them, so we reduced that number. This is the number that was turned in, and I still think it might take another month or two to see if an actual disaster is declared on that. And the last one, I'm sorry, there on E, category E, public buildings and equipment, the transit dock gangway, the bank above it slid and went underneath the gangway, and when the tide went down, the gangway hit that pile, which broke the hinge pins going up. So it looked worse than what it was, but that was $2,890 in fixes. Any questions?
I just find it kind of remarkable that they could look at that and go, $387,000.
It is. So that money is based, that number is based upon, I called Jack and asked him how much lineal footage, you know, how much per foot of our bank, how much, you know, would that cost repair? It's about $1,000 per foot when you go down the bank to fix. So we take the slide areas that are there and then measure that distance and then apply $1,000 per foot to that.
That makes sense. Okay. Billing advertising.
Okay.
And the motorcycle down.
So in our last meeting, we approved to advertise the building as vacant to see what proposals might come through for fixing the building. The building, obviously, I had some more pictures, does need a lot of work. I initially had the publishing going for about 2 months because I wasn't super hopeful we were going to get a lot of people. So far to date, I've already got two people that have came in that seem to be pretty interested in spending the money to fix it. So first, I would like to shorten this to 2 weeks and see what else comes in to give any of the people that are currently have proposals ready for us that we don't drag them out 2 more months farther into the summer and delaying what they might want to do. So I think we can start with running this for 2 weeks, bring in any proposals that we have, review them, come to a meeting. I'm hoping to have that at our next public meeting, and we can decide on a selection of any of the proposals that came in and decide what kind of lease or proposal we look at to see what has to be done to shape that vision of whoever's coming in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I
think it's just fair that we put it out there to see and give anybody an opportunity, and then it'll give us something to look at, and then we can make a decision from there.
Good.
The board has no intention of putting any money into it. We intend.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. To be clear, the notion here is that we have a port asset that we're going to allow somebody to make an offer to us that they'll fix it up and bring it up to code and do all the things they need to do, and then we'll negotiate that in some lease somehow on their way.
Depending on the proposal piece, depending on how that's shaped and formed, and what can actually be agreed on.
Yeah, plus what they intend to do with the building.
Yeah, I mean, depending on what the proposals are, we're just going to have to look at those and make decisions once we get those.
I wouldn't call it the most desirable way to do it, but I think it's the most realistic way for us to approach this at this point.
Does it have a bathroom?
Yes, it does.
But if we do anything with that building, we have to hook it up to Harbor Sand, right?
It's hooked up to Harbor Sanitary, hook it up to Harbor Water, because right now it is on a submeter from our dock water that cuts across, so we would have to, so a water line would have to be tapped into the main harbor line out on the street, and that building would have to have its own meter that was metered by harbor water. That cost estimate's around $11,000. You do have to cross the county road. That's why it climbs so much.
And is that a tenant improvement, or is the port going to pay that?
I'm going to wait to see what kind of proposals are made and see how that gets shaped.
Okay.
With that, depending on the proposal, we might look at it saying, we'll put the water line in if you do that, or you know, the person doing the renovations might have to. It's all going to depend on the proposal, what they bring.
Okay.
The two people have shown interest. Do you know what their intent is?
One was a wine tasting, and then another one was like Myrtlewood beach type sculptures and wood and things like that. So, yeah, something along those lines. So those are the two proposals that I've gotten so far. I'm sorry, the two people I've shown interest. I have one proposal that's already been submitted from the winery, wine tasting place. So.
So they're pretty serious.
I would, yes, they are serious, and it's another reason why, since there's people already coming to us before this ad even goes out, that's why I want to shorten the time and get this process moving along sooner than later.
Okay.
What was the monthly rent for the motorcycle shop call park?
$755. That building also, I believe, in its lease came at a reduced rate. I don't think we charged the whole. I would have to look at it. It was in bad shape when he got it. I mean, I'm not going to say the entire building's fault lands on him. It was a tough, rough-looking building before, so.
Okay. Excuse me. You were gone when we did an inspection of that building with Tiffany and the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name. But anyway, the contractor said that building could be upgraded for $50,000, which I don't see that being a realistic number. But it'll be interesting to see what somebody else comes in with.
All right, anything further on the motorcycle slash tattoo parlor slash barbershop? Bill? Okay, now I'm going to handle this one like this. I'm going to talk about the 4th of July RV parking and traffic.
Can we take a couple-minute break?
Okay, yeah, let's take 2 minutes, or let's take 5 minutes. We'll be back in 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think traffic control on the 4th of July is the sole purview of the budget officer, if I recall.
It is. It is. It's in the fine print, but it's in there.
Sounds about right.
We'll have your fitting for your orange vest here.
Okay.
Hey, ready? Okay, we'll come back in order and talk about the 4th of July.
Okay. So, again, you know, on average, there's about 1,300 cars that travel through the RV park per day. Last year, during the 4th of July, there was an accident that led to a fatality and numerous RVs and vehicles damaged. I felt it necessary that we sit down, we talk about that, and see if there's any changes that we feel we would like to see, want to implement with it. There's roughly 90 parking spots across the front row right there. During the RV park, during the 4th of July with the congestion and what happens, right out of the gate, what I would do is close that gate all day long. You could walk, you know, you could park anywhere that you typically would park. Granted, there might be 90 extra cars out there trying to park somewhere because they can't park in the front row. And keep it closed all day. The port would staff one of, you know, our employees at that gate that lets RV park guests and event staff, any type of authorized user of it, and keep that gate closed all day. Now, I know that might not be a very popular opinion amongst everybody, but the amount of people that come down to the beach to watch it with a limited amount of parking and the amount of cars that come through there all day long trying to find the one parking spot, I don't think it's necessary for them to have to park down there. So me personally.
Reality is that those 90 spots are taken up pretty much the day before or the day of the fireworks. So people are going to go sit in the back of their car or their truck and watch the fireworks. So most of those cars pull in and stay there all day, which exacerbates the traffic flow problem. I spent about 5 hours down there last year for the first time, including when the accident was, and it is a concern to me, the amount of traffic, both pedestrian traffic coming in and out of that RV park, a lot of kids on bikes, and just a lot of people driving. And, you know, we're in the situation here of weighing public access versus public safety. So I wouldn't feel too bad about closing that gate at noon. I'm just saying, you know, after that until tomorrow you're done, unless you're an RV park occupant or somebody involved with the event. But that's just my feeling. I mean, it's a tough call, but I certainly, especially after going through that accident last year, I'd sure err on the side of public safety here.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. Public safety is more important.
So
I have a suggestion.
Go ahead.
I agree we should close the oceanfront off to pedestrian only. But also, we're going to just create a monster traffic jam with no parking available other than the paved area we have over by Basin 2. I think we should provide parking on the kite field for a $10 fee for the day. With that money, we could turn around and hire how many stalls are?
Kind of re-looked at it. I think 150 cars would probably be a number. I think we just have to lay it out, but I think 150 would keep it more of a comfortable. I think if you jammed them in there, you could get 200, but.
So if somebody wants to come in and park for the day, they pay us 10 bucks. We in turn take that money and hire buses to come down. You know, the fireworks don't start till 8 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
So, you know, the reality is you would provide parking over here by the boatyard and here, wherever they need it, and we get some buses that we pay for to transport the people over to the kite field. And then they walk, set up wherever they want to set up, and watch the fireworks. The only thing that I can see is we need, you know, we could run one bus during the day, but once you hit crunch time, we need multiple buses going immediately, you know, around, turn around with virtually no time between them. I don't know what a bus costs to run.
Okay.
But that would be providing the service, the parking. It's just an idea.
Curry Public Transport has done that before. In fact, I was driving for them when we were shuttling people back and forth. And, you know, they don't have anybody running at 10 o'clock at night, so I'm sure, well, I'm not sure, but that would be someone we could ask.
Yeah, we've also got the trolley.
So, Ken, wouldn't the fireworks committee have the responsibility of running those buses? I mean, why the port?
Well, I don't know how that is set up. To my knowledge, they just run the fireworks. I know Oregon South Coast Fishermen provides some certain amount of labor for them. The fire department, I think, controls the entrance. There's quite a few volunteers involved in that whole process, but I don't think, I don't know, you'd have to ask. But they don't have the money, I don't think, to hire buses. The only thing I'm proposing is that we charge the $10 fee in the kite field, which would give us the opportunity to hire buses to take care of the customers or the clientele that come down there and want to see the fireworks.
Okay.
I'm sure there's other ideas that could be, but you can't just close, in my opinion, you can't just close the parking area down there and leave it to the parking that we have available over at Basin 2. That's just not adequate in any way, shape, or form.
Well, that's if you want to go to the beach. I mean, for many years, I watched it from the launch ramp.
So, right.
I mean, there's multiple areas where you can see the fireworks.
Let's watch it from the camp.
No, I think that gives me a few ideas. Because the other thing is too, when the front row is closed off, I was thinking for more access for people that comes in there, is that we could just cone off and put caution tape, you know, go 20-30 car slips there, 20-30 car slips, and just let people put up lawn chairs or whatever they want in the parking stalls. So not everybody feels, it's just a usable space that can be used that isn't typically for RV park guests. Usually there's always cars parking there or something. So you could just, and so they didn't have to go down on the beach. You could just let them set up in a parking lot right there, which would allow more people to come down.
Yeah.
So is there any other suggestions for?
If you're going to charge for the kite field, not that I want to push anybody out, but I would suggest that around the Basin 2 over there, the front row would be reserved for mortgage holders only, so that if they can get in and out to their boats, to alleviate blockage from and being able to park to get in and out. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's something that you're going to have to look at, because there are times when people want to get to their boats and they can't do it because there's no parking. And they all have, mortgage holders all have parking permits anyway, so it would be easy enough to identify them to start with.
I think
some parking for the mortgage holders.
Mortgage holders before I know on the kite field side.
Yeah.
And just so, and we can do that with the other side. That's fine. Typically, though, just so everybody's aware during this, I think it's usually 10 parking spots, 10, 12 parking spots per side on each end that we give. Obviously, we have more boats and mortgage holders than we do parking spots. But we'll do the best we can to accommodate for the mortgage holders.
What are you going to do about the traffic? You're going to use that
parking lot.
It's going to have to use that parking lot for traffic to do go through. I think we have enough cones, we have enough, you know, traffic type barriers to set up to keep that flow of traffic going. The other thing is if you drive down there on the 4th of July and you make that turn down there, you should know exactly what you're getting into. It's tight, it's slow, there's a lot of traffic. If you didn't know, you won't forget it. I would assume that the people going down there probably have a good idea, but I think we'd utilize that circle.
Okay. All right, let's move to the lottery fund, a lottery bond, economic development.
Okay, so I received a email from Senator David Brock Smith to asking for any projects that could be submitted to him for the lottery bond economic development. I had about a week to put everything together, fill out the application and put it together. I chose this project because of the uncertainties on Basin 2 West Bank slopes. We got our approval from FEMA to start dredging. And once we start dredging, we need to have a solution for our banks put in place, or we're just going to keep pulling down more materials. So we've done a lot of engineering. We have drawings, engineering done. It's kind of a shovel-ready project once we have funding. So that is what I chose to submit for this project. That was more information for you guys just to know.
Okay. Questions,
comments? Thank you, Travis.
Okay, that brings us to project update.
Okay. So I did have Jack come here for this. The overview of this is FEMA. When we talk FEMA now, we're talking dredging. HMGP, when we're talking HMGP, we're talking paving and storm drains, in particular to the commercial area, and then the wastewater treatment plant for fish processing. Jack sent me a kind of a project update that I put in here with it. I didn't really know this was kind of an in general thing that he was for contractors. So we handed you guys another handout. I think it looks just like this. Yep. This is much more specific to what we have here. So that's what we're going to read off from. Jack, do you want to read it? Do you want to take it away?
It's up to you.
Do you want me to read it?
You can do whatever you want. That's fine.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't have one. Give me yours.
You can have it. You wrote it, you read it.
All right. Put the microphone over there.
All right. Okay. That's all you get.
All right.
Straight away. Is it? Guess what, please?
All right, fine. Okay, what should I do? Should I just read it?
I would just read it.
Is there any questions?
Just explain.
Okay. Well, first of all, I wanted to kind of summarize the projects and get a little information on where we are in terms of permits and money and, you know, equipment and everything like that. So I started off arbitrarily with talking about the dredging project. We have the money in hand. We are ready to go. We're getting reimbursed. So we talked about purchasing a small electric remote control dredge with a generator. And you may recall that we looked at that as a lower cost alternative. We are investigating other alternatives, by the way. But we're only talking about the 38,000 cubic yards utilizing the dredge for that. However, the way FEMA works is as long as we use it for in-kind work after we've gotten rid of the 38,000, we can continue to use it. So it becomes a port asset and utilized for port projects. The particular small remote control dredge is attractive and is ever increasing in its use among small ports because you can cherry pick or focus on
problem areas. You don't have to wait for a big dredging event, which you get to get the money for every 8-10 years. And then you have to find a place to dispose of it. And the big dredge, can you really use a big dredge effectively to dispose of sediment on upland? Okay. I talk about some of the challenges we have and we've been facing regarding storing and getting rid of our own sand. And we have a lot of options there. And we're reviewing some others, which we, Travis and I were just speaking about today. We have a challenge to remove 8,000 cubic yards in a year with the smaller dredge and the time we have and the learning curve. But and getting rid of the material in a single season. We think that's going to be pretty easy to do, but we just got to make sure we cross our T's and dot our I's. I've tried dotting the T's and crossing the I's. It doesn't work very well. So now we have a dredging process finally going. We are working on the embankment repair of a little bit less than 1,000 feet at the west embankment in the south basin. You guys have been just talking about that regarding the lottery funds. the HMGP and or the lottery funds could be used for this, and part of the function of the dredge can be also to help with creating the scour base that I need for the wall. So we're just opening up keeping our options open for the in-water work period. We completed the application, the permitting's in process. We think we'll be ready by August or September of this year. For having our plan ready to go for procurement. Now, the permitting is also pretty much under control at this point. We have some limitations as far as the amount of material we'll have to dredge and keep in what's called a nationwide permitting framework. That's the way we always want. We don't want individual permitting for this kind of work. We avoid it. Also, work in the commercial area, of course, primarily paving and stormwater catch basins and piping will be upcoming. $1.2 million was set aside by the HMGP for that project. Now, you guys don't know this, but I should probably make sure that you do if you don't. When we originally were working with FEMA, who up until just the middle of last year had categorized us as Category G, and we're all happy and think, oh, this is great, you know. And then they changed the category. I've been apologized to, but that's not much consolation. We have had, I at that point anticipated that we better keep HMGP in the mix. Okay, we just don't know what's going to happen before that change of line that they made. So HMGP and I, we agreed we're going to take $1.2 million and set it aside. That's going to be ours if everything goes wrong with FEMA, right? So we have that $1.2 million, which is really dedicated to the commercial area at this point. You could choose the RV or the boat basin, but 1.2 fits the commercial basin requirements pretty well, especially since the wastewater treatment project can extend its asphalt and stormwater work pavement up until the point that we've revised the commercial area. So we can actually make it all single paving, continuous paving area. And if you guys don't know what I'm talking about if you picture where the wastewater treatment plant is right going to be right now, if it is going to be, that we're allowed to do paving, prepare that broken condemned dock, and we're allowed to include that all in the wastewater treatment project. So the $1.2 million then, which was because of inflation, we just couldn't do as much with $1.2 million as we could in 2020. So this assistance from the wastewater treatment project will work well as far as accomplishing our original goals. So we don't think we'll get to the RV Kite Field and Boatyard paving stormwater work until 2024 and or 2025, that period of time in there. As you know, FEMA...
And that's another, that's a different application process, right?
That's a different application process. However, we've already started on it.
Okay.
So there's no reason to think that, that we won't receive funding because we've got ourselves a pathway with HMGP now. We have a natural hazards mitigation plan. It is up for renewal, but it's not going to be much to do that. And we're conforming with that plan and all this work. So, as you know, FEMA, while admitting they messed up, have changed our category G to A, thus restricting our 4432/4452 project to dredging and referring us to HMGP for the rest. HMGP, by the way, has been a willing partner in this and understands our issues. And so does Business Oregon, by the way, who has maintained that no matter how we break up these projects, they're still going to maintain their cost match. The good thing about that is that subsequent HMGPs are going to be available at 10% matching rather than the 25% matching, which will allow us to accomplish more with the same cost match amount. As mentioned above, my earlier request, because I was anticipating possible need for some backup, HMGP set aside $1.2 million, plus the $2.4 million for dredging commercial work area. This leaves RV kite fields and boatyard projects, which we have been encouraged by HMGP to pursue. I have an email from them as recent as 3 weeks ago that where we were encouraged to go ahead and start pursuing those projects. So they are giving us priority due to the FEMA mess ups, but still HMGP takes some time. So that's why I'm putting it up at 24-25. The total funding, originally limited to $4 million with 25% equals $1 million cost share paid by Business Oregon, is now $2.4 million plus $1.2 million, or $3.6 million. So a reduction of $400,000 with $900,000 paid by Business Oregon. However, the remaining projects will still be funded. And according to HMGP folks, that's Mott and Feigum, those two people who I'm in contact with a lot, there's a 10% match available. So another $1 million could be obtained from HMGP with the remaining $100K still available from Business Oregon. And I think I mentioned to you, Business Oregon is aware of the category change and has slated, or stated that they will adhere to the $1 million commitment to the port. So we still will accomplish our projects with additional funding to do so. This is fortunate because inflation beyond expectations have occurred since these budgets were finalized and submitted to FEMA in 2020. So it's actually fortuitous, although it's kind of a pain in the neck. So, that unfortunate step with FEMA is kind of turning to the best interest of the port in the long run. As you know, the port has received $3.5 million from the U.S. Congress to install a wastewater treatment system at the port. With that money, we are also planning to repair the adjoining condemned commercial receiving dock that we sometimes refer to as the old Pack Choice dock. Is that it?
Thank you, Patrick.
Okay. We're hoping to engage with that work this year. However, it would be good to look at that again with some fresh eyes. It's about 100 feet wide of concrete decking, top wood pile, and it needs some serious repair. I'm talking about, of course, the old BC, the old Pack Choice dock. The permitting and funding processes are all moving forward regarding the wastewater treatment plant. The request to waive the $875,000 share was reviewed by the R10 EPA people, approved, and sent to their final reviewers. I spoke, by the way, to top person Region 10 today, who told me that they are looking very favorable on that, and basically they think the prospects of getting that waiver, which is a considerable amount of money, is, in her words, very, very good. That's not something you usually hear from regulators.
So to be clear, this is the match?
This is the match.
$875,000.
For the $3.5
million. So there's a chance here, a pretty good chance we're going to get the match waived.
Yes, according to them, a very good chance. So along those lines also, we're speeding things up because I pushed for it. By the way, the reason we get this, the match, or why they're entertaining it, is they have a series of litmus tests that you have to undergo. The process I had to go through was I had to utilize census data to convince that this is an economically disadvantaged area. Now, that was easy for Curry County. I was able, there's nine possibilities, and you only have to match one. Okay. I got seven of those by Curry County, seven litmus tests by Curry County. I sent it to them, very satisfied. They came back and said, you know, the uppers are saying that Curry County, we're not sure that the special district is too far to say the special district is represented entirely by the Curry County. So you're going to have to get tighter on your census data. Well, I found out that they have something called census tracts. Census tracts are basically smaller areas, and they approximate, we could approximate the central, the district special. So I had this, the district put on CAD on a drawing, and I had these tracts put on, overlapping them, and I demonstrated to them that these overlapping tracts are almost hardly anybody living in those areas that are not in the special district. And the special district, which has, you know, they say 16,000, I think it's closer to 15,000 people in it, compared with the 23,000 in Curry County, I made my case. So I submitted it to the EPA, and I satisfied. There was only one. The problem with the census tract is they didn't have enough data. All they had that I could use for the test that they gave, the nine possible tests, was household vacancies versus occupancies. But we compared that with those of the state. We had a certain percentage lower than them. We passed. So I submitted that to them. So according to their protocol and their guidance, we have it. Now, secondly, I've gotten their verbal assurances that, and I see they've passed it up to the next highest level, which is the final level. And I know the guy that's going to look at it, and I don't see any good reason why we're not going to get the match. Hey, look, I could be wrong, but so we'll see. But that's a lot of money, and that was worth going for. Finally, the KTEX, which is here as categorical exclusion, is saying, putting forth to them that they should minimize the amount of environmental EHP stuff that they should be looking at. I spoke with her today about that, and she said, because I sent her a lot of data, you know, we've done a lot of work in this port, and all of it's permitted, and we've been through the environmental ESA, you know, Endangered Species Act stuff, ad nauseum. Okay, so I took a lot of that documentation and submitted it to the EPA, past projects that we've done here, to push this, because it would mean that, because if they accept all this, that means that we could get the full money within weeks from now. Okay. If not, I'll find out the middle of next week. If we're going to have a longer wait on this, more trouble, like it could be a month, maybe even 45 days. Okay. If they push it and say that we're going to enforce environmental, I have an option to go into phased, where all I got to do is change a few, separate out a little bit of budget information, submit it to them, and I can get all of the engineering, past and future, all of the permitting, including the $30,000 permit fee, if we go for the permit, all that stuff covered, paid for. And that's within weeks. So either way you look at it, we're going to get reimbursed within weeks. I have to do a few things to make sure that we get it. I got to get a couple of jurisdictional stuff and some procurement protocol that they wanted me to fill out. But except for that, and I'm trying to push with SHPO, because SHPO, because some of this stuff is within the vicinity and some of it on top of, maybe on top of, the tribal areas, the cultural resources, that is where we could get held up. Either way, we're not going to get held up because we can go to phase, and we can get the reimbursement anyway. So that's the stance, that's what's the status there.
That phase makes sense to you? Then what they'll do is draw a line down it and pay for permitting and engineering and costs associated.
Yeah, in fact,
away from construction.
There's a borderline possibility that I can even if we decide to, and it's not even necessary since the permitting has to be done before anybody would even think about getting equipment. Plus, there needs to be discussions with Pacific Seafood. That's we're almost going to be at that level, that point when we finally have money in hand, we are ready to talk turkey, and then we take everything and talk to bring in everything for management and then for commissioners. And that's another thing I think that Travis was going to mention to you about Pacific Seafood. Because we've been on dialogue with them for weeks on making sure that they have expressed their concern, their interests and concerns and desires and positive stuff about their feelings and their commitment to the Port of Brookings Harbor. That's really super important and integral. So the last requirement for the dredging permit, the WPC 401, has been submitted. This is dredging again, the 401. But, you know, the problem is with their hardware and having a little trouble. I'll get that worked out soon. So regarding the LUCS, that's the land use compatibility statement for the wastewater treatment plant. I'm just going back to the plant now. When I submitted that, we were really, you know, it was copacetic, no problem.
In that?
Well, the reason why I had to submit it was because, well, I originally submitted because it's part of the requirements for required submission, but because they have a whole bunch, the county has a whole bunch of code problems out here. You know, BC Fisheries was permitted against its own code. Marine activities, believe it or not, are not supposed to happen along there. So they never really changed their code. Consequently, our code wasn't changed for that reason. But then there's some issues some people had, I think, during the public hearing, which I've been informed about and have answered regarding sludge questions. Planning asked me to describe sludge. I gave them a very, very complicated description of what happens to the sludge on really any system, but more particularly on this system that we were looking at right now. Now, remember, when I first talked to you guys about wastewater treatment plant, I introduced a relatively sludgeless system, totally aerobic, except for a small amount of clarifier material. But it was kind of not looking good. You guys didn't like it. Nobody liked it because it was a large system. Remember the one with the big canopy? So, but it's basically sludgeless. So you have almost no sludge with a system like that, totally aerobic kind of system. But this compact, tight stuff does a lot more screening, and so consequently has the sludge. But it was designed, the reason I designed this system, and not by myself, was to give the Cadillac, since we had the money, to make sure that we'd be able to accomplish any future concerns regarding permit limitations. And now some are coming up, not so much with us, but those that are holding 900Js, they got some serious problems coming up. But we went with individual permit. So we have options to work with the mixing zones and if the publicly owned treatment works, they treat us a little differently. And there are a lot of advantages, even though it's a much more expensive permit, the individual permit, which I guess in our case is fairly moot because it's being paid for by the government. But it is much more versatile permit that allows us a lot of latitude as far as mixing zone study, which allows us, we have a mixing zone study on this already, but it allows us to expand the dilution factor to be able to make sure that we can meet and accommodate their requirements. Plus, the system I put forth to you guys has the ability, if it comes down the road, the ability to take care of metals. And And if metals come up, because it's coming up increasingly along the coastline, we can, with coagulants, be able to utilize the DAF that we have, this particular DAF, for that reason. So that's really pretty much the summary of where we are with these projects.
So it's, thank you.
Yeah.
I did put in front of all you guys this letter. I received it last night from Pacific Seafood.
Mm-hmm.
Basically outlining that they are excited about what's happening. They do have experience in the wastewater and operating these systems, and are willing to look at what partnering and operation of that facility will look like. They have expressed a lot of willingness to come down here and talk with the board, you know, answer any questions and kind of just show their face here saying, yes, we want this. So I was going to have them come at our April 10th special meeting, which is in a couple weeks, and have them come down, I guess almost 3 weeks, and just talk with you guys, give them 15, 20 minutes and know that, you know, if you guys have any general questions that they can answer, but they would like to come down here to show you guys that they are excited about this and in support of it.
And then that would be the time when we could discuss sitting down and developing a business plan or a work plan, how we want to approach this.
It'll be the first time we talk, like he states, that Tony DuPont, I think if I said his name right, he's no longer with them. You know, Gary, who originally was here. So it's new people on both sides. So this would be back to a good square one to come back. We could talk about those things, talk about what you're, and start being able to draft an outline of what that's going to look like. I did talk to James, our attorney, as well, to give him a heads up that we were approaching this point. That we were going to start having these conversations, and I made sure with them that they have the legal expertise to take this project on, you know, and help us develop a plan with Pacific Seafood and any other entities that end up coming to this to put together what it might look like. And Jake seemed to be very confident in making that happen as well.
I did have a question. With the dock repair, I don't know where all the problem is. I'm sure some of it's underneath as well as on top. And so is that something that has to be repaired during an in-water work period time as well?
Yes.
Okay.
But the timing of where it is right now and the in-water work period being October through February, and what's coming, it is in our favor to have that work done.
In the wastewater treatment statement here, paragraph 4, can someone tell me what is a community grant guideline?
Community grant guideline?
Yeah, community grant
guideline. That is, you might be able to take it. It's instructions and guidance that are given to us by EPA, which is the Region 10 grants, who is handling our funding.
So it was given to us right away. It's public information. Anybody can get it.
Okay, so there's with this sizable amount of money, there's not an election, there's not a ballot that goes out to the community itself.
No.
So the money, the money's granted. It belongs to the port. It's just a matter of going through EPA requirements, government requirements, as far as getting the money. We have to go through environmental stuff. We have to go through applications.
I wonder why the community. Kind of got double blade sort of.
Well,
okay.
I think it means community. For community improvement, I think so. For the community.
Two questions. One, what time is the meeting going to be on the 10th of next month? And secondly, how big is the suction on the dredge that you're talking about?
2 p.m. for the meeting on April 10th, and the dredge suction pipe, 6-inch, and I think can be up to an 8-inch.
It's an 8-inch.
It's just a straight suction dredge?
Pardon?
Just a straight suction dredge, or is it kind of like a steel pedal rotary?
It's used by water jetting.
The
It's got a cutter on it. I have videos of it operating, which I've shown.
Well, I'm going to tell you now, it's not going to work because there's been too many over the years that have provided flow tests for stuff into this basin, and you're going to screw your head up. You're not going to get your material removed. You might want to figure something better.
It's, we've already done such and dredging here, you know that, right? We did it pretty much in 2011.
Okay.
In fact, we did it actually also in 2016. So we know we have cutter head. We put protection on the cutter head that's necessary. And it certainly has worked and will work.
Okay, anything further on project updates? Hard to cut to the chase on this. The forecast for Sacramento River is 169,500 returning adults. That's below the guideline of 180,000. The guideline is 180,000 to 122,000. The performance of that model has under forecast for six of the last 8 years by as much as 40%. So the feeling is that there's actually about 100,000 fish forecast to go back to the Sacramento River without fishing. The upshot of that is that the FEMA guidelines, or not FEMA, the National Marine Fisheries Service guidelines were about as wishy-washy as you could find. Their guidance to us was that you need to use extraordinary measures on this fishery, and that's what they did. So the upshot of that is there will be no directed summer fishing for Chinook salmon from Cape Falcon, Oregon to the Mexican border. Our decision in Oregon was that we have about 896,000 lower river Columbia coho forecast for the ocean, which is what we normally fish on. These are all marked fish. So our decision was to take whatever Chinook impacts we could to support that fishery, because you have to, when you're catching and releasing Chinook out there, you're killing them, some of them, so you have to have impacts. So that's kind of what happened. California, this is a very political issue in California right now, because Governor Newsom in November made some move to give the ag industry a whole bunch of water that was supposed to go to salmon. And a lot of people in California decided they were going to show him about that by having a closed season. So nonetheless, California's question to us is, what kind of impacts are you going to have in some of the other fisheries we'll talk about? And are we going to be able to have anywhere, any parity? Because California has a huge, well not huge, but they have significant credit card impacts because they fished in September and October last year, which means those fish don't count against the model. They count against this year's number. So they looked at this year's number versus what our projected fisheries were. It's about a 60-40 split with us getting 40%. So they said, okay, that's fine with them. So we're off and running. I'll talk about commercial trolls north of us from Cape Falcon to Humbug Mountain. On alternative one, September 1 through October 31st, all salmon, which includes Chinook, 100 Chinook allowed per vessel per landing week, a quota, coho quota of 10,000 non-marked select fish, no more than 50 coho allowed per vessel per week. Alternative two is October 1 through October 31, all salmon except coho, 75 Chinook allowed per vessel per landing week. So this is an Oregon credit card fishery. The rationale behind that is that there are a lot of north migrating stocks that are coming back down the coast of Oregon. We would like to be able to access those. Generally, our Klamath and Sacramento impacts have been very low in those 2 months. So the idea is we may be able to get as many as 1,000 Chinook caught in that fishery with fewer than 50 impacts for Sacramento. Alternative three is closed. The Humbug Mountain, the Oregon-California border, closed in all three alternatives. Oregon-California border, the U.S.-Mexican border, closed in all three alternatives. One significant thing that came out of this is California has finally recognized they're over-harvesting the hell out of these fish. So they added this language into what's called the boilerplate. These are the annual management guidelines that says landing limits in California may be implemented and or modified in season to sustain season length and keep harvest within pre-season expectations. So they now have joined the rest of the world in how salmon are managed. So they're going to manage their salmon fisheries the way we do, with regular weekly updates on harvest, closures if necessary, and trip limits. For recreation, from the Cape Falcon to the Oregon-California border, alternative one, marks Select Coho Fishery, June 17th through the earlier of August 31st, for 110,000 mark coho. All salmon except Chinook. Alternative two is the same dates with 100,000 quota, no Chinook. Alternative three is Cape Falcon to Humbug Mountain, June 17th through August 31st, and 90,000 coho, no Chinook. And then Cape Falcon to Humbug Mountain, September 1 through October 31st, all salmon except coho, two fish per day. So that is a Chinook fishery. Alternative 2 is September 1 through October 31, all salmon except coho, one fish per day. So the non-marked select fishery from Cape Falcon to Humbug Mountain, September 1 through the earlier of September 30, or 25,000 non-marked select coho, all salmon, two fish per day. So there's a Chinook fishery there. Alternative two is September 1 to September 30, or 20,000 non-marked, all salmon, two salmon per day, only one of which may be a Chinook. Alternative three is 15,000 non-marked coho, all salmon except Chinook. For Humbug Mountain, the Oregon-California border, we're in the same fishery, so June 17th through August 31st, or part of the 110,000, no Chinook. Alternative two is June 17th through the early of August 31st, or 100,000 mark coho, all salmon except Chinook. Alternative three is closed. For the recreational fishery from the Oregon-California border to the U.S.-Mexico border, closed. So, appears and most likely we will have a coho fishery, a marked select coho fishery, and there's a pretty good chance we will have an October bubble fishery. But that one we're going to have to be real careful about how we do that, because that will be a target fishery. We will be the only Chinook fishery available close to California. And I've already gotten calls from Eureka wanting to know, are we having a bubble fishery, because I'm a guide and I want to come up. So,
October.
Dates to be determined by ODFW.
Ocean.
Yeah. Well, no, we're going to, yeah, it'll be the ocean plus the discussion about the estuary and the river at the same time. Enforcement of our $300 fee is going to be pretty important this year, particularly in October. So.
That's
the salmon picture. It's not good. It's projected to be as bad or worse for the next 2 years coming up. So, I don't have much to say. It ain't great. So, okay. Commissioner comments. Okay, hearing none.
I have a quick comment.
Okay.
The county called me yesterday about the cleaning of the catch basins at the hotel parking lot. apparently hasn't been done in 2 years. That was the last time they were here. So I was asked if we could help assist with making sure that cleaning got done right, so nobody was getting fined and anybody in trouble. So they're going to come down tomorrow and low tide's at 2:30. So at 1 o'clock, we're going to set up our turbidity screen at the end of that pipe, so no extra dirt or material is traveling from the site. so they can go down there and dig that out. So I told them that we would be happy to help contain the end of the pipe so nobody's getting in trouble to get that cleaning done.
It's pretty heavy coming out.
It is. Well, right now it's clean. It's as clean. The basin's dirty, but the water in the creeks have all since cleaned up. One of the methods that's typically said on their side is, well, we'll do it while the water's already dirty. That's not okay. You still have to put up your control measures and help do that. So in the scope of getting that, stopping that material, when that rain event we had, I took a video of it. You can hear rocks through the pipe tumbling down it. I mean, they have to be this big rolling down there. So getting that cleaned up and getting that catch basin to where it can start catching the material again, I think is in everybody's interest. When I was talking to the county, it doesn't supersede any of the material that's still in the water in that conversation. But I just wanted to let you know the county will be here tomorrow. We will be helping assist making sure that happens and rules are confined to. That's it.
Charles, can I ask you, are we still moving forward with the slam and famine?
We're not doing it.
So far, the application has been turned in, and it is still on.
Is that for July 3rd? Was it last time it was proposed? July 2nd?
July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, I think, is what they have it slated for.
Stress test comes out.
That's for Zolas, right?
No.
No?
No, that's Chrissy Cooper and...
Chrissy Cooper, and I believe it has to do with the high school fishermen
Michelle
club.
Michelle Cooper, the high school fishing club.
That's it.
Well, I would just make one interesting observation about the salmon season. California commercial trawl has overfished their model expectations by as much as 200% for the last 3 years. So if you take the model escapement forecast, you take the overage above model expectations of what they actually caught, you add the two together, we would have made escapements for the last 3 years. So we're great at telling everybody what conservationists we are and that we're really concerned about the fish as the fishing community, but apparently when we're coming over the bar with a plug full of iced salmon, we're going to make good money on them. We're not so concerned about it. So this is a case where we have overfished the stock. So, disturbing to me. All right, our next regular meeting date will be Wednesday, April 19th in this room at 2 o'clock, and with that, we are adjourned.
Goodbye.
Quick question for the commissioner. The $40 we need to know.